It's terrible this weekend. It was slow, slow, slow.
You guys have the kid hunt.
This coming.
Yeah, no, that's okay. As long as he's
we'll go out, me and my boy will go out Saturday because he's got a birthday party to go to Friday night. Just take care of him, man.
Folks, we're going to get started here. Thanks all for coming, and thank you for I'm going to start here in a minute. I believe everyone should have a copy of the agenda. I just want to make one quick note that on agenda item number 6, is a combined, that item is combined with a special meeting of the Affordable Housing Committee. So for Brown Act purposes, just for folks to be aware that that item number 6 is a public hearing item. So
the purpose is we'll have a majority of the Affordable Housing Loan Committee present.
Correct. That's basically the reason why. Yeah, so while I'm trying to put up the PowerPoint here for the CSD, so while we do that, why don't we start with introductions real quick, and I'll start. I'm Taro Chiburu, I'm the Planning Director for the City of Elk Grove.
I'm Randy Starbuck, I'm the Director of Economic Development for the City of Elk Grove.
I'm Sarah Bontrager, I'm the Housing Program Manager for the City.
Oh, so you're Sarah. Okay.
Yes.
I'm Mike Monasca, I live here in the city.
I'm Angela Frost, Management Analyst, and I work for the City of Elk Grove.
I'm Jamie Bandy, Finance Analyst, also for the City of Elk Grove.
I'm Rick Renfro, Building Official, City of Elk Grove.
George Apple, Fire Marshal, Cosumnes Fire.
Richard Shepard, Director of Public Works for your city.
Mark Madison, General Manager of the Elk Grove Water District.
Bruce Camillus, the Engineer for the Elk Grove Water District.
Andrew Keys, Accounting Manager, City of Elk Grove.
Jim Gillen, Gillen Consulting.
Thad Johnson, Property Owner.
Matt Spokley with Wood Rogers.
I'm Jay Pollock, Taylor Morrison. We're a home builder here in Elk Grove.
Christopher Jordan, Planning Manager.
Brian Spillman, Silverado Homes.
Mike Kelly with Pacific Companies.
Bob Ressler with Parks and Rec Director for the CSD.
Jeff Ramis, General Manager for the CSD.
Blair Oz with SCI Consulting Group.
Darren Wilson, Engineering Services Manager, Public Works.
Rick Carter, CIP Manager for the city.
Brad Kane, Finance Director for the city.
And Becky Craig, who just stepped out, Assistant City Manager. Okay, so we have quite a long agenda today, so we're going to try and get through this as quickly as possible. Normally, I would do a quick summary of what we're going to be going through, but since it is kind of long, we'll just jump right in. The first item right there says CSD Parks. There's a revised condition language, and we have folks from the CSD to explain that. I think it's something that we had kind of thrown out there in previous meetings, so you're here with the details on that. So
great.
Take it away, folks.
Real quick, thanks, Darrell. What we're proposing to do is to institute a new community facilities district for the operations and maintenance of our parks here in Elk Grove.
Jeff, sorry to interrupt. Just one quick additional thing before we get going. I believe that this meeting is being recorded. Is that correct, Mike? Are you going to record the whole meeting?
Sure.
Okay. Just for folks to be aware, it's being recorded.
Right.
So,
want to stress that this CFD is a replacement of the existing LNLs that we have. We have 13 different benefit zones throughout Elk Grove. So this would not be on top of our existing landscape and lighting fees, but would be a replacement of that. And so we have our district engineer here who will go through the report for you guys, so we can jump right into that.
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning, everyone. And here's the remote. Great. Why don't I just come on up here? So as Jeff indicated, our objective here is to essentially, for all new development projects going into the future, is to replace the landscape and lighting assessment for those projects with the community an updated community facilities district special tax. Right now, and the district can certainly elaborate, but the benefit assessments for these areas have been are quite outdated, and they are not reflective of the maintenance and the replacement costs that are needed to provide the level of service that is in the master plan for the community Cosumnes Community Services District. So we're essentially replacing that mechanism with just this new mechanism. And I'll just briefly give you a sense of the methodology, but the real primary objective is to have sustainability with this special tax. It's just too hard to have an assessment that ages over time, and then it's just not reflective of the actual costs to provide that level of service and to provide for those replacement costs. And then what the district's having to do right now is to go into some of the communities where they have these situations in existing development areas and go back to the property owners and have them unapprove an updated assessment. And so we're trying to fix that going forward for new development and establish a mechanism that can have some sustainability. So for those that are not familiar with the Community Facilities District Act, just really briefly, it allows for facility options to be financed, and so those that are have a useful life of 5 years or more, so parks, recreation, and open space facilities are an allowable cost component. Services options, the CFD Act allows for quite a few different services to be financed as well, and parks and open space maintenance is one of those. Just briefly, for those not familiar with Community Facilities District, it's really the guiding document behind a CFD is a rate and method of apportionment, which defines the maximum tax that would be charged, the how the annual tax would be determined each year, and any special provisions for the determination of that annual tax, how it's levied, how it's collected. And in comparison to a benefit assessment, one of the benefits for not only the district but just new development, that it allows for some flexibility and creativity in how the annual tax is determined and charged and levied. And so there's really benefits for both developers and the district in using this methodology versus a benefit assessment. The methodology must be fair and reasonable, and it's typically determined based upon lot size or density, and so there's a number of different methodologies. We'll go into exactly how we've proposing to calculate it here. And so we just... So the one of the key components of this special tax methodology is that we first determined the maximum allowable special tax that could ever be levied on that particular property. And that's actually based upon a level of service that's consistent with the district's master plan. So, and then we also, for any given year, we determine the actual level of service that's being provided by the district, and that's actually the annual tax. So, just to exaggerate, to illustrate the point, if this CFD was in place and next year they were able to construct facilities and actually reach their master plan goals of 5 acres of community parks per 1,000 and down the line, and they actually achieved their master plan, they're providing that level of service, the special tax would be able to adjust accordingly. So each year the methodology is such that it adjusts with the level of service, and that's certainly fair and reasonable in that it's if you have more parks to maintain or more landscape corridors to maintain or more facilities to replace, that you want to have that adjust accordingly. Let's see. So we have done working with the district, an exhaustive analysis of the district's cost for routine maintenance, deferred maintenance, park replacement, and we've identified, based upon those costs, and again, these costs are on a district-wide average, so we're not looking to have replicate different zones. It's actually just based upon a district-wide average, and if based upon those costs, if the district was at their maximum level of service, it would be $590 per EDU, but because of where their existing level of service is at right now, it comes out to $433 per EDU.
What's an EDU?
Equivalent dwelling unit. So I'll just jump forward here. So based upon the average household size for these three different residential land uses, and then based upon the employment density for these non-residential uses, and we also calculate, we don't double charge, so we're also calculating non-resident employee impact here. So this is somewhat fundamental with just impact fee, sort of a nexus type of an approach. These would be the maximum tax, and then the annual tax for perhaps the first levy year for these different residential land uses. So again, the range would start if we did the math based upon the all the cost components, and then the district's level of service, it would come out to this range, but in 5 years, if they were able to get closer to their level of service, or in the instance that their level of service dropped, then the resulting tax rate would drop accordingly. So it's growing with it's adjusting with the changes in the district's level of service. So this is the condition language that we've prepared with the city that is here, that is requirement. And then just a few words about the ballot, the election. It's a landowner election, and it starts off with a petition consent and waiver form that's sent to the developers that indicates their interest in annexing into an existing CFD. And we prepare a boundary map. And then there's really only two board actions. One, we take a resolution of intention. The governing board of the district accepts the petitions from the developers, accepts the boundary map, and then the resolution outlines that that these given properties wish to enter into the CFD. After that resolution, a ballot's mailed to the property owners. Of course, we receive 100% support because they're being conditioned to enter into the CFD. And you follow up with a subsequent action 30 days later, where you pretty much do all the remaining tasks, which is canvass the ballots, hold the public hearing. You then either form the district initially, or you actually do the annexation. Then you call for an election, and that very quickly the ballots have already been sent to the district. You've already mailed them out and received them, and thus you actually conduct the election, and then adopt a resolution with the results of the election, and following up with a levy of that actual annual tax for the subsequent year. So really. Pretty straightforward process. So we're really at this 90 days prior, just working through preparing the rate and method of apportionment of the special tax. Election rules, pretty self-explanatory. It's based upon two-thirds of the two-thirds support of the landowners in that formation or annexation, and one vote per acre or the portion thereof. And that's just sort of a quick summary. So we are certainly able to answer any questions that you might have.
Landscaping lighting districts would go away in their entirety and be replaced by the CFD?
That's correct.
Not in their entirety, for at least for that development.
This one for new development.
New development, yes.
All right, so for new development, yes, there would be no L&L benefits on the CFD. So
how does this deal with things like entry monumentation and small sort of non-global facilities, landscape facilities that are included within specific maps that have been addressed by specific lighting and landscape district items because they didn't have a global benefit? And I'm thinking Franklin Crossing, so it has a couple of little entry monuments and a goofy little landscape strip that clearly only benefits the 300 something folks that are there, and right now it's being dealt with as an upzone
in our, and we have our maintenance services CFD,
right?
And in Jay's particular circumstance, we have zones that are not geography based, they're service based, so the higher up you go, the more service you require. And so he's in a higher zone than the baseline because he has additional landscaping that we're maintaining in that case. I'm not sure that those are parks though. That's I think what the question is ultimately.
Okay, that's my question is,
yeah.
So and bear with me, I'm not having a better grasp of it. So what we're talking about is adding a $600 a year tax per year. Essentially,
at the max tax,
it's $580
a
year.
Yeah.
So when
right,
I'm disclosing
right.
to a home buyer, I've got to disclose to them an additional $580 a year max tax rate. That I don't have to disclose to them today.
Well, it's actually replacing $250 to $400
I'm disclosing a tax increase
right.
of between $150 a unit. I have the same fundamental problem that I've had with this with every additional services CFD, that my new resident is paying $580 a year more than the person that lives across the street from them and receiving the same community park benefit. And it just seems fundamentally unfair to me
that a new resident who gets to use the same park doesn't get priority reservations for the shade structures, doesn't get their kid on the slide two times to the other kids once, but they're paying a rate that's significantly higher than the neighbor. And in here, like going into the Laguna Ridge stuff, when you get the next maps of Laguna Ridge, it will literally be right across the street, and you'll have guys that are paying significantly rates that are significantly different for no additional service. And clearly they're paying with the CFD rate now, a component that their original property tax rate or whatever the CSD is collecting off of property tax was meant to address. And again, I just have a fundamental problem that new home buyers are paying more. And it seems just unfair that they're being burdened for the same services.
We've got police, we've got Elk Grove has a CFD for trails and open space. You're adding this, another $600, I think our place is paying. At what point do you break the back?
I mean, you're probably loading on the better part of $1,000 a year of additional property tax for, again, same services the guy across the street is getting for zero. And it just, again, to me, it draws parity issues. If the district were to go forward and to recommend adopting a CFD citywide that included charging the same $600 a year rate, I would wholeheartedly support that because it would equally apply to everyone, and I would have no problem because everybody's paying for the service they agree to. Here, you're forcing my hand to make my folks pay because I don't have a choice. I'm coming in for a map, like you said, you're going to get 100% support because I've got to move forward. But if you go out to the city as the whole and you say, hey, everybody, to get the perks that you guys want and the maintenance level that you want, will you pay this $580 a year? I would hope that the city taxpayers would say yes, but I suspect by the way the district's approaching it, the district thinks that they would say no. And again, to me, if the taxpayers at large would say no, then perhaps the level of service or the number of facilities or whatever it is needs to be brought in line with what the taxpayers are willing to pay for.
How is your current CFD structured? I just pulled up a tax bill from one of my client's parcels. So how is that built? Is it built on square footage? Is it acreage?
The current L&Ls?
Yeah, non-resident.
Non-resident by acreage.
By acreage. Okay, so it's consistent. When it's developed out, it'll be the same. I've got a 103-acre parcel that's being charged $12,000 a year. And it's going to have about 1 million square feet of retail when it's done, maybe little bit more, and that's about 41,000 based on your max tax. So that's going to be over three times the current rate.
Well, yeah. So the difference here would be first, this would be actually be based upon building square footage,
right,
rather than land.
Good.
And then this does not charge undeveloped property as well. So it wouldn't be until you actually develop that property, the subsequent. After the building permit is issued, that subsequent year is when it would be the first.
Right, but my point is that if I've got a property that's currently 100 acres of commercial that I intend to put 1 million square feet of retail on, which is a real life example, it's actually 1.2 million. But and it wouldn't apply to this property. I'm just looking at this in terms of what is the net increase to my clients, because I have other clients that haven't developed yet, and it looks like it's about a multiplier of 3. Over what you're currently getting today. So you got the residential context, it's an increase of a couple $100, which is...
I don't know necessarily if you multiply it at 3. I'd like to look at that for you, but I'd be happy to do that. But,
okay.
But
well, I mean, 100 acres, 443,650, add 2 zeros, and multiply that by 0.25 FAR, and that's where...
You know your project better than I
do. Well, I'm just general numbers. I mean, retail coverage is about 0.25. And I some quick math will get you the answer, but that seems like a pretty significant increase. And you know, our contention is that a lot of people that if the city has their way, a lot of people that work in Elk Grove live in Elk Grove, and so we're kind of getting double ended on these type of things for non-res uses.
So where it states on the first page, CFD special tax rate shall annually adjust with changes in district level service. The district will determine the level of service, and then they'll adjust the tax rate. And it'll cap at 5.9 for residential. That's correct?
Correct.
Plus CPI.
Yeah, so there'll be a consumer price index tied to it as well. So that adjusts the cost, but then annually, just the level of service would be calculated as well, and that could be a potential adjustment.
I have a question about the process of, or the rate fee schedule, rather, on page 4, is it? No, sorry. No, it is page 4. You have a rate per square foot, but you have a rate per unit for residents. Is there a residential rate per square foot?
As it's being proposed, we just take a based upon the average household size for those three land uses, we just have a rate per housing unit.
So it could
certainly be adjusted to the square footage based upon the size of the home as well.
Well, if I live in a 2,000 square foot residence and my neighbor lives in a 4,000 square foot residence, do they pay twice as much by this scheme or this rate? Or is there a rate?
No, so...
No, there is no rate, or...?
If you have a 2,000 square foot home, you're going to pay the same rate as a 4,000 square foot home. It's
okay.
It's 5.9 across the board.
Then my next question would be this. If if a retail and a residential sat side by side, one was a 2,000 square foot home, the other was a 2,000 square foot coffee house, which would be a rather large coffee house, but nonetheless, just for the example purposes, at 4 cents a square foot, that would be roughly $80 a year, right? And you're saying that I better own the coffee house because I won't be otherwise able to pay for my residence because it's going to be $590 versus $80 for the place next door. And let's say that residence and coffee house are directly across the street from a park, and people are attracted to the coffee house because it's such a beautiful place, you know, and so they go and get their coffee, and sometimes they stay in because it's raining, but when it's a nice day, they go out and use the park. Those are customers, not people who otherwise live there, let's say. I get that benefit as a coffee retailer? Okay, that's a yes? That's a yes.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
How is the cost, on slide 7, the cost established for the items that ultimately break down into the annual number, and what method was used in generating those? Because obviously that gets to the number at the end of the year, whether it's 590 or 440 or whatever it is. What goes into those cost pieces?
Yeah, so we took the routine maintenance costs for a small, medium, and large park within the district, and then also calculated the deferred maintenance for small, medium, and large parks, and then we also went through the replacement cost of a typical small, medium, and large park, and then the replacement cost for the district-wide facilities as well, and came up with a component to be able to meet those replacement costs and the maintenance costs as well.
Why is a new home buyer who's paying for the new parks to be constructed in their existing fees, why are they paying for a deferred maintenance component when they're buying something, the facilities that they're installing are new, so there's no deferred maintenance on those from the beginning? I mean, I understand replacement, and my next question would be, what's your duration that you're throwing into replacement? Because in theory, if they're paying fully loaded routine maintenance, you should never have to do a full bulk replacement of the park. Its lifespan should be indefinite. So I would think,
except for the playground. The playground is
okay.
The largest 20-year. I think we use 20 years as the life cycle.
So there would be a component of that park, but certainly not the entire park facility, because you're not going to replace. Again, if you're doing adequate and quality maintenance, your landscape areas are going to live
right.
short of minor replacements are going to live indefinitely. Yeah, your hard facilities are
right,
certainly going to replace.
Most of the time, it's if there's a tennis court, not the smaller grand tennis court, basketball court. a playground has a resealing component to
sure.
it.
Oh, sure.
Some of those things are the major deferred maintenance ones. There is some
But those deferred maintenance items wouldn't be picked up. You know, you wouldn't be deferring those. Those would be maintained as needed in your normal maintenance schedule or in your replacement schedule. You wouldn't, because you're fully maintaining them from day one under this new facility. For a new home buyer, because their facilities are brand new on day one, but you're fully loading the maintenance of those, so you're going to reseal on whatever your 10-year resealing schedule is. You're going to...
Right. Because we're talking, as Blair said, we have routine, deferred capital. I think you're saying it should be either routine or just capital.
I mean,
there are two categories.
To me, it's all, there's really one category. It's all maintenance, and a component of that maintenance is on certain timelines you may have
right.
to replace
Correct.
Facilities.
Correct.
To me, again, the idea of deferred maintenance is you're already behind and I'm paying to catch you up, which I understand the... You know, that on existing facilities in the city, there may be a deferred maintenance component, there may be a replacement component where you're already behind, but for a new, I mean, this fee is only applicable to new development, so it's only applicable to newly constructed park facilities. So again, I just, and maybe it is semantics, but I'm not, again, I'm not sort of not understanding those pieces.
So existing, you fund them through property tax, your share of property tax.
No.
How do you fund park shop?
Completely by the L&L. There's not a dime of property tax that goes to the L&L. That's why we got problems, because we have districts that were formed in the 1980s before Prop 218, and so we were charging whatever it was to maintain those facilities we had. A great example is Elk Grove West Vineyard. Several park sites that were undeveloped at the time. Probably to maintain all of those at full build out, we should have been charging $150, $175, $200 at the time. By the time, we were only charging $80 because they weren't developed. Prop 218 comes along and says, "Oh, sorry, you can't just raise your assessment whenever you need to. You have to go out to those other people," which we did. But at the time, we were charging, say, $85. That's what we left it at to make sure we were able to keep the money we had. We knew we were going to get to a problem 10, 15, 20 years down the line because one, park costs maintenance is going up. We have these parks to come online. Now we're at the point here, we're at that point, and we did go out to a vote, and it got rejected 2-1.
Well,
and
100% get it, and believe me, I 100% get it, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I, you know, I understand the point, but... The challenge I've got to go is to explain to my buyer who's coming in or my new resident who's coming in and say, you're paying this $580 a year, and their expectation is going to be that their park is maintained to a higher level than the guy down the road who's paying $85 a year because he voted to not pay $580 a year. And it should be that way because he doesn't want to pay for it.
Right.
So,
right. And there are, I mean... There could be an example of that. There's a development out in Elk Grove West Vineyard right now that's coming through, a self-contained development that's going to have two park sites in there. That development, should they approve the CFD, we can say, we're going to build these two park sites for you because we have the money to maintain it. So somebody who lives across the street who or a mile away who doesn't have their park site built because we don't have the money in the rest of the district, not going to ever get there, honestly,
yeah.
Unless something changes.
But is the park facilities that exist in the other part of the city, and again, I bear with me, and I 100% get what you're trying to do. You've got a park in the east side of Elk Grove that exists, because there are plenty of them that exist, and you've got a park in the south portion of Laguna Ridge that just gets built and has the same 500, do they get the same level of maintenance? Because these guys are paying $580, these guys are paying $85. Are both the facilities going to get the grass mowed, you know, the same twice a week and get the same weeds pulled and get their play equipment replaced on the same schedule?
It depends on where that park will
grow. Or,
these
or are you going to defer maintenance on the new facility because you don't have enough money district-wide to fully maintain all the facilities? And their playground equipment's going to get to 20 years and it's going to wear out and you're not going to replace it. And because that equipment's already 10 years old, it's going to get there at 10 years and you're going to replace it.
with money that these residents have paid. And again, that's I just don't know how you solve that again, other than an entire district-wide tax that failed dramatically. And again, it's hard for me as the new home developer or the new home buyer to swallow being forced to accept a tax that the rest of the residents wouldn't accept, and yet the money from my area is going to go to fund their facilities. And it will. I mean, there's no way you're going to draw the line and say, okay, this money has to stay within this specific boundary of this project, because it's clearly not how this is being set up to fund. And I don't know how to work through the box, but it's very troubling.
Jeff, could you speak a little bit about what are the next steps moving forward? Or?
I think the next step is just to take it before the board of directors for the district and to get their
Do you guys have a schedule for that?
Next couple months, I think.
I think we're going May or June.
Do you have any other questions for this group?
And one last thing, we'd be happy to sit down with any of you to kind of go into the detail if you wanted to kind of look at the detail.
I get it. It's incumbent on the industry has problems with this as a whole, and you know it. Whether it's 580 or 578, I don't know that I draw a strong distinction as a home builder to that, but I appreciate you guys coming and talking.
Great. Moving on, what I want to do actually is move the agenda around a little bit, because we do have some guests here. So, in respect to their time, I'd like to jump next to item 5, and then we'll do item 6, and then pick up the agenda after those two items.
Is that
plan? Yeah. That's how we do things.
Thank you.
Me, Tarl?
Yes. So, please, Mark.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Mark Madison. I'm the general manager of the Elk Grove Water District. Here today with me is Bruce Camillo. He's our associate engineer. And I think, as most of you know, we've been tracking Sacramento County's efforts to fluoridate the water supplies in this area quite closely. I just wanted to give you a brief update on the timing of that and what I know. Sacramento County received an appreciable amount of grant funding through First 5 of Sacramento. I think they received about $6 million, which was intended to cover a good portion of the capital construction costs related to equipping about 38 different sites with fluoridation equipment, including the new water treatment plant recently placed online by Sacramento County. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but you know, fluoridation is a pretty controversial subject. Most water agencies throughout the country are in fact fluoridated and have been receiving fluoridated water for many, many years, but it has remained a very controversial topic. We get calls on it quite frequently. And anyhow, the county's plans are to fluoridate all county supplied water. City of Elk Grove, most of the water served to the City of Elk Grove is Sacramento County supplied water, with the exception of a portion of the Elk Grove Water District service area. The Elk Grove Water Service District service area is comprised of that area of Elk Grove, primarily east of 99, all the way over to Bradshaw, but our service area 1 stops on the east side at Waterman. If you take a look at the map behind you, I won't poke you in the eye here, Taro. So here's 99, and so the area that I'm going to be talking about, this is Bond, this is service area 1 up Waterman and Bond. This area right in here, service area 1, is fed exclusively or almost all the time with water that we manufacture. We produce the water from our own groundwater wells. All other water, and that includes our service area east of Waterman, so this area in here, and north of Bond, is fed or supplied with Sacramento County wholesale water. So all areas of Elk Grove except for service area one, which I showed you, will be receiving fluoridated water. The timing of that is this. Between now and March, Sacramento County has informed us they will be testing their fluoridation equipment. And they plan to go live and launch the fluoride equipment on or past the middle of March, as I best understand it. They are going to be sending out postcards. Richard, have you been contacted by Sac County at all? Okay. They're going to be sending out postcards to all residents that will be receiving fluoridated treated water. And I've solicited an extra of like 100 postcards, but they're going to be going out to all of our customers in service area two as well. So in my opinion, they've done an adequate amount of public outreach. I think more would have been a little better, but anyway, get ready, here it comes. So anyhow, it's the middle of March. All areas of Elk Grove are going to be receiving fluoride treated water, except for service area one. Our governing board has decided that we will not be pursuing fluoride equipment for the areas which we supply water directly to. Okay, that's the decision that our board has made, and that I recommend. So anyhow, that's the short story here. Any questions on that?
Did you say District 1 just goes up to bond and stops?
In general. There are some minor nuances to the boundary, but in general it goes up to bond. Everything north of bond will be receiving fluoride. Now, George, I would also stay in touch with Sacramento County because they do have some supply facilities in our immediate proximity that will likely be storing hydrofluorosilic acid. So there may be some toxic, you know, constituents that you might have to worry about from a fire safety or health, you know, perspective. So anyhow, you can call me anytime if you want further information on that matter.
Why do you oppose fluoridation?
I have recommended against it for our particular district for a number of reasons. Cost is one. Fluoride is a derivative of fluorine, which is a very toxic constituent, and fundamentally, it can be difficult to, I guess, accept the notion of putting a toxic compound in a water supply. So but by the same token, fluoride has consistently been shown and demonstrated to improve teeth and reduce cavities. So there's a lot of pros and cons against that. And there's more philosophical information that banters back and forth, in my opinion, than scientific data on this issue. So in my presentations to the board, I have presented the pros and the cons with my initial recommendation that we not fluoridate, and that's where it stands right now. But that's obviously a policy call.
And did your discussions include the latest EPA recommendations for reductions in infusion of fluoride in fluoridated systems because of the fact that we were seeing more fluoride treatments, and it was multiplying. It had a multiplier effect.
I don't quite understand your question. I tried to include all of the latest information that I had at that time, including recent reports from the Centers of Disease and Control about the impacts of fluoride on children less than the age of two. So again, this is really a hot topic. It is really a hot topic, and I think that emotions far exceed scientific data. But nevertheless, that's the decision that our board has made at this time. But I can tell you, again, Sacramento County is going forward with this program to fluoridate the water supply, and the timing should start in March.
It's regulated by the FDA or EPA or both?
I don't recall. I'd have to go back and search my notes.
Yeah. think what you're talking about is it's temperature based, and so you have to regulate based on temperature of the water, how much fluorine you put into the water.
No, it wasn't a temper. It had to do with the levels that were being seen that were necessary, and they wanted to lower the dose. And it went from, you know, just under 2 parts per million, I want to say, down to below 1 part per million.
Good memory. It's around a part, but it
okay.
is temperature based. Dosages.
Oh, okay, maybe.
Dosage has to vary based upon temperature.
It would help to know if it came from FDA or the other. And so a lot of times that's part of the sales job, too. I mean, being able to say to people, well, here's the empirical evidence. So thank you.
So anyhow, that concludes my update.
Thank you. So next up, Sarah, we'll talk about the housing fee. And just a quick note on this item. You know, in the past, we've shared with you the Nexus study and so on. We've discussed that quite a bit. What we want to focus on today are the policy options moving forward. You know, you've all seen, we've had plenty of discussion on the fee itself. And so we just want to make it, have our conversation be focused on that. So with that, Sarah?
Yes, so I'm going to pass around some sheets here. I guess we could split them, maybe some on both sides. And I'm going to grab Suzanne, who wanted to sit in for this.
So there are two handouts. One is for residential and one non-residential. So just so you get one of each.
To remind everyone, this will be a special meeting of the Affordable Housing Loan Committee. We have two of our committee members here. John Costa is there, and Brad Kane, our finance director. So we do have a quorum under the Brown Act. So we will call this meeting to order at 11:53. And then we do, as a regular item of our Affordable Housing Loan Committee, we do provide an opportunity for members of the public to comment on items that are not on the agenda. The only item on today's agenda, of course, is the Affordable Housing Fee Nexus Study. So is there anyone wanting to comment on general matters? No? Great. Okay. So our committee, can we have our two members of the committee approve our agenda? Which is just the Nexus study. Yes.
Make a motion.
Great.
Second.
Okay. So now we'll start our discussion on the Nexus fee study, and we have. So you have two spreadsheets in front of you. Oh, did we? No, there were the same amount of both. Are there any more residential spreadsheets?
Bring them down.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Do you have one?
Oh, you don't.
Okay. Did you guys? Okay, so does everybody who wants a spreadsheet have a spreadsheet? Yes? Okay. So as you know, we commissioned our fee study from David Rosen and Associates, and they updated the Nexus study for both the residential and the non-residential fees. We held the industry working group meeting in August to discuss the fees, and then we also had an advocates meeting, I believe, in September. And we incorporated the feedback from those groups into the document. And so you all received a copy of the new document. And we made some significant changes. I'll just run through the changes quickly. One of the things that we were requested to do was incorporate the effect of other federal and state financing, for example, tax credits, that most affordable housing projects receive, so that we can more accurately estimate the actual gap the city would be responsible for. We removed acquisition of existing rental housing as a viable option because there are a lack of properties and not much data for the Elk Grove area.
We updated the calculations to address the double counting of employees created by new residential and non-residential development. So that was a big criticism, that we were double counting those employees. Some of the employees that we said would be generated by residential, the commercial non-residential was also paying a fee on those. So we removed that factor. And then we added adjustment factors to account for household members not responsible for housing cost payments, such as teens or other people, you know, who may have a job, a part-time job, but don't actually contribute to housing costs. And we also added an adjustment factor to account for Elk Grove residents taking local jobs. And then we created one blended fee rate for residential and non-residential, where we weighted 60% towards acquisition of existing owner housing and 40% to new rental construction. And that mirrors the 10-year breakdown ownership and rental in the SACOG region. It's roughly 60% owner and 40% rental. So our fee calculated on that as well. And then, so the overall effect of those changes was the maximum fees dropped by approximately half in most of the categories. So our residential fee went from $12,600 in the draft to now $7,000. And the office fee, for example, dropped from 1982 down to 1007. The biggest drop was in the commercial fee, which went from almost $27 down to $4.70. And that was where we saw a lot of the double counting there. So we've developed some fee scenarios that you see in front of you. These are the options that we could put forth to council, and so we just wanted to get some feedback on these. On the residential side, you see we have no change to the current fees, 20% of the maximum fee, 50% of the max fee, halfway between the current fee and the max fee, and the maximum fee. And on the residential side, we also wanted to discuss some possible options in lieu of actually paying the fee on the project. One option would be land dedication. So the city could accept a donation of land subject to city approval. We would obviously want it to be in a good location and viable to compete for tax credit funding and any other funding resources we thought we could get for that. And then also, we could also consider an inclusionary option where the developers could actually build the units themselves and either sell them to this to low-income people or donate them to the city or a city-approved nonprofit, again, at the city's discretion. So so let's start with the residential fee.
I have a quick question, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
So, so other than these fee recommendations, you're going to be recommending changes to the ordinance itself?
Yes.
That reflect land dedication?
Well, we could, depending on the feedback that we get from this group, and then we'll be meeting with the advocates, the housing advocates in February to get their feedback as well, and then we'll take that feedback and provide that to the council. So, but those are two options that we thought of that we've heard that other communities have used successfully. So.
Okay.
Has your report been released?
Yes.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Where's, in what form?
It's we have a PDF of it.
It's on the city's website. Okay.
Well, this version is not. The early version is. I can put this version on the website if you'd like.
Okay, and what about your presentation? Is that part of the agenda?
No, that's just kind of my talking points.
Okay. Usually there's if there's a staff report, it's made available.
That's not going to be until March, Mike. This is us drafting it right now.
Yeah. Do we have minutes from the last meeting? The last two meetings that you mentioned, the August and September meetings?
They were not. We did not have a quorum, so it was not in a formal Affordable Housing Loan Committee meeting.
So these were both informal?
Yes.
Sarah?
Yes.
$7,000 fee, what percentage is for moderate income housing and what percentage is for low and very low?
0% is for moderate. We determined that moderate income households at this point in time can afford both rental options and for sale options in the community. Of that $7,000, I believe $400 is for low income and the remainder is for very low. Other questions?
No question.
I know. So is there any feedback on preferred options?
We would recommend the 20% rate option, Sarah. Imagine that.
Okay.
And if you had a 10% rate option, I would have recommended the 10% rate option for the record. I think it's consistent, the 20% rate is consistent with what the council did the last go round. So essentially all you're doing is updating the background data behind it. So I think the logic holds. And at the 20% rate, the city has been able to generate a significant number of affordable housing units over the last 10 years. So it's clearly 20% has been successful at resulting in positive change in the city.
For residential.
But 10% would have resulted in as well.
Yeah. With regard to the non-residential, I continue to have a disagreement with the idea that creating jobs makes it harder to live. So it would be my belief that you should zero out the non-residential fee. At a minimum, not raise it. The council has a very clear goal of bringing high quality jobs to the city, and an increase to the fee associated with office or commercial counteracts that goal and continues to drive people to Sacramento and Rancho Cordova to find their jobs, which increases their cost of living.
Does the city give, or does the report rather give consideration of that fact, the jobs, housing imbalance in Elk Grove, the fact that there is a
We did account for the fact that some of our local residents would take jobs in Elk Grove, and those residents are currently working elsewhere, and so those were removed from the calculation because they already have housing.
How did you come up with that assumption? I mean, what percentage? You don't need to do it right now.
Okay.
Just email me.
Okay.
There's a percentage identified within there.
Yes.
New employees that will be living here.
Right.
Something that you mentioned there was preferable would be no fee, and next would be keep the fee status quo. But if you'll notice, option two actually has a reduction in certain categories, which are possibly targeting areas of interest, such as the commercial and the manufacturing, although it would then adjust others. So we didn't know if that was something that the group would have an interest in also, is to have it resized.
And the ones that adjust are those that, if you look at the far right, are the furthest off from what the max justifiable would suggest is the fee. So
that was the rationale for doing it that way?
Yeah. It basically updates the ratio because we've identified that there's a bigger imbalance between
warehouse
and hotel and what we're charging currently and what the actual generation of
what gets categorized as warehouse. Is it strictly a warehouse, non-industrial flex type space, or is it what falls into that category? Because I kind of consider the sort of flex space general commercial as more of a likened to office than retail than warehouse, because it does
right. I mean, if it has the use,
And I just don't know how you parse that out, but certainly a decrease to manufacturing jobs is something that would be welcome, as well as retail.
You have to choose one of the options here. Yeah. It's option two.
Right.
But to Jim's point, there shouldn't even be one of the job generating uses.
Right. Right. We understand that. Yeah.
But thank you for pointing out that you are looking to lower some of the if you can't lower them to zero, the more you can, the better.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the same question I asked the water district. The 2,000 square foot home that's a residence versus the 2,000 square foot retail that the rates would be based on square footage as opposed to per unit. And are you saying that the single family would still pay at option four $1,400?
These are impact fees, Mike, that are only paid at the time of pulling a permit.
Right. So it's
these are one-time fees. Yeah.
Right. So if you're when you're pulling the permit, you're paying $1,400 for the 2,000 square foot home, whereas if you have a 2,000 square foot commercial retail at the 20 or at the option two that you're suggesting would be 46 cents a square foot, right?
Yes.
Which would be about $800, right? Or $900, something like that.
Yes. Yeah. About $900.
So the single family requires a greater contribution from the builder or whoever's pulling the permit versus the coffee house or whatever retail. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
When do you expect to have this in form to go to the council?
We hope to take it to the council in March. So we have a meeting on February 13th. There will be a meeting of our Affordable Housing Loan Committee again, and they'll consider the housing advocates will also attend that meeting and give their comments on the fees and some of the policy recommendations. And then after that, we'll combine that feedback and take it to council in March, hopefully. Are there any thoughts on whether the land dedication option or the sort of voluntary inclusionary are preferred? Do you want to see those? Do you not want to see those? Would you prefer just a simple fee?
Can I speak on behalf of the BIA?
Yes.
Okay. You know, our preference would be a fee, considering one, it's simple. And we know up front, certainty-wise, what cost or impact would be. The other is the city has performed under that fee to produce a certain percentage of housing. So the justification for keeping the fee where it is. On the flip side, though, despite the Nexus study that justifies a fee based on the gap, the industry still doesn't believe that the creation of new home construction creates the need for such a fee. Or creates an impact at which we should be mitigating for. I want to make sure that's not lost in these discussions, despite what's being proposed today. And I appreciate the fact that you guys have looked at various options, especially given the state of the market. But, you know, the industry still doesn't believe that there's a nexus between the creation of new construction and the creation of those needing the gap financed.
You said this is going before the advocates on February 13th?
Correct.
Were the advocates advised of this meeting?
The advocates, I've talked to several of them. They're aware that we were planning to speak with the kind of two main groups of stakeholders on the issue.
Were they invited to come to this meeting? Or?
No. Not specifically, no.
Who are they?
The Affordable Housing Loan Committee was invited, and one of the other committee member who's not present today would be considered among that advocates group, and she was made aware of this meeting. Now.
Yes.
So the advocates were aware of this meeting.
Well, this meeting was announced Friday, right?
It was a special meeting, yes.
Announced Friday?
That's when it was posted, yes.
Okay, and then in order to allow ADA accommodations, any disabled person who required ADA accommodations would have had to have made that accommodation request by when for today's meeting?
A transit request, is that what you're suggesting?
No, ADA accommodations for this meeting.
Oh, for this year?
As soon as the. For hearing or?
This is a Brown Act meeting.
Yeah, well, as soon as the person was aware of the meeting and informed us of the need, that's when we would have heard. We, as far as I know, no one has.
No, that wasn't the question, Tara. The question was, the ADA accommodation was supposed to be made, right? It's
if there was a request, I mean, it's always available, I think that the notices talk about if anybody needs special accommodations, to let us know and so on.
And
that would have been with the meeting notice.
Right, and online, what does it say about ADA accommodations? It says that you have to give 48 hours notice of the request for accommodation. That's what I read on the agenda that you have online.
Okay.
It does say notification 48 hours prior to the meeting will enable the city to make reasonable arrangements. Mm-hmm. However, you know, less than that notice, we would certainly do whatever we could to make those reasonable arrangements. We did not have anyone make any request at all.
Well, and I think that that speaks to the issue of when the special meeting announcement was made, that it was made Friday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that in order to have given 24 hours notice or 48 hours notice, two business days or whatever, it would have had to have been done simultaneously. I'm concerned that there are no, that this table is absent advocates. There should be advocates at this meeting as well.
Well, again, Sarah explained that we will be meeting with the advocates to discuss this. Keep in my mind that, Mike, that part of the reason why we called a special meeting is because we realized that there would be two members of the committee in attendance of this particular meeting, which wasn't, you know, this was not a typical intent of a housing meeting, but since there were two members that we knew would be present, you know, the Brown Act issue came up, and therefore we were doing the right thing by noticing the meeting as a special meeting, because it wasn't regular, just to avoid any, you know, any perceived conflict there. And again, Sarah has explained, I mean, if someone with ADA accommodation needs would have contacted us, absent this 48 hours, we would have done our very best, so anyway, that's what I can say about that. Again, and the meeting with the advocates, again, Sarah has been in touch with them, and there will be follow-up meetings, and the committee will also discuss this very same topic in future meetings. So by no means are we just trying to, you know, accommodate one group over another.
Who are they, the advocates? Are they, do they represent different legal organizations?
Yes, the advocates we invited to the advocacy meeting would be the Sacramento Housing Alliance, Legal Services of Northern California. We invited many of our affordable housing developers, USA Properties, St. Anton. There's a few others that we invited.
What about the disability rights advocates?
Not specifically. Are you thinking of a specific organization?
Yeah, it's called Disability Rights.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I can add them to the list.
Okay.
Do you have contact info for them? Is there a particular person to contact?
Yes, I can get that information to you, actually.
That would be great.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll make sure that they're invited to the 13th meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Turn other comments? Okay. Well, since there are no other comments, we will adjourn the special meeting of the Affordable Housing Loan Committee at 12:15. Thank you.
Thank you. And a good segue to maybe we should have lunch now. It's served. It's right behind us. So, and then we will move on with the rest of the agenda. So feel free, and maybe we can catch up the agenda as we're eating.
Tara. I'd like to give them an update on the race study work that is underway right now relative to
the
I hear you move. That's okay with you.
Thank you.
Other contact information. I'll get back to you about DRA fluorination
contact.
Yeah, because they have they're gonna. How's everything going with you? They have links with the other organizations in the National Alice NC and Grayson. I don't know who they will send.
Okay.
He hasn't downloaded your run up to my dad. Okay.
So do you need my email? Do you have my contact info? I don't have one out here.
Oh, just here. No, just give me some
Okay.
Even though most of your service areas,
it would be helpful to see your staff report because I'm not familiar with any of this background.
Yeah, so the Affordable Housing Loan Committee is a little bit less formal, and since this is a special meeting, we didn't have a staff report go out for it. If we did, it would have been posted online.